there any more to this story, or is that it? Oh, there's more. She started talking about goddesses, I remember, about how they were hidden away. And you think Huzzar's found one? We saw acolytes in the mountains, didn't we? Why not a deity? Maybe Huzzar did go dreaming for her mother, but instead she found a goddess. Yes, Tisha Lulay, out there in the cradle, waiting to rise. You like the idea, don't you? Of hidden goddesses? Oh, yes. Maybe it's just the woman chaser in me, or maybe I'm like Huzzar, waiting for someone I can't remember, wanting to see some face or other come to fetch me away. I'm already here, Pi said, kissing the back of Gentle's neck. Every face you ever wanted. Even a goddess? Ah. The sound of the bolts being drawn aside silenced them. The guard had returned with the news that Captain Narshap had consented to see the mischief. If you see Aping, Gentle said as it left, will you tell him I'd love to sit and talk painting with him?
I'll do that.
They parted, and Gentle returned to the window. The clouds had thickened their defences against the suns, and the cradle lay still and empty again beneath their blanket. Gentle said again the name Huzzar had shared with him, the word that was shaped like a breaking wave.
Tisha Lulay.
The sea remained motionless. Goddesses didn't come at a call, at least not his. He was just estimating the time that Pi had been away, and deciding it was an hour or more, when Aping appeared at the cell door, dismissing the guard from his post while he talked.
"Since when have you been under lock and key?" he asked Gentle.
"Since this morning."
"But why? I understood from the captain that you and the mischief were guests, after a fashion."
"We were."
A twitch of anxiety passed over Aping's features.
"If you're a prisoner here," he said stiffly, "then of course the situation's changed."
"You mean you won't be able to debate painting?"
"I mean you won't be leaving."
"What about your daughter?"
"That's academic now."
"You'll let her languish, will you? You'll let her die?"
"She won't die."
"I think she will."
Aping turned his back on his tempter.
"The law is the law," he said.
"I understand," Gentle replied softly. "Even artists have to bow to that master, I suppose."
"I understand what you're doing," Aping said. "Don't think I don't."
"She's a child, Aping."
"Yes, I know. But I'll have to tend to her as best I can."
"Why don't you ask her whether she's seen her own death?"
"Oh, Jesus,"
Aping said, stricken. He began to shake his head.
"Why must this happen to me?"
"It needn't. You can save her."
"It isn't so clear-cut,"
Aping said, giving Gentle a harried look.
"I have my duty."
He took a handkerchief from his trouser pocket and wiped hard at his mouth, back and forth, as though a residue of guilt clung there and he was afraid it would give him away.
"I have to think,"
he said, going back to the door.
"It seemed so easy, but now I have to think."
The guard was at his post again when the door opened, and Gentle was obliged to let the sergeant go without having the chance to broach the subject of Scopeek. There was further frustration when Pi returned. Narshap had kept the mischief waiting 2 hours, and had finally decided not to grant the promised interview.
"I heard him even if I didn't see him," Pi said. "He sounded to be roaring drunk."
"So both of us were out of luck. I don't think Aping's going to help us. If the choice is between his daughter and his duty, he'll choose his duty."
"So we're stuck here."
"Until we plot another plot."
"Shit."
2. Night fell without the sun's appearing again, the only sound throughout the building that of the guards proceeding up and down the corridors, bringing food to the cells, then slamming and locking the doors until dawn. Not a single voice was raised to protest the fact that the privileges of the evening, games of horsebone, recitations of scenes from Quexos and Malbaker's Numbubo, works many here knew by heart, had been withdrawn. There was a universal reluctance to make a peep, as if each man alone in his cell was prepared to forego every comfort, even that of praying aloud, to keep themselves from being noticed.
"Narshap must be dangerous when drunk," Pi said, by way of explanation for this breathless hush.
"Maybe he's fond of midnight executions."
"I'd take a bet on who's top of his list."
I wish I felt stronger. If they come for us, we'll fight, right?
Of course, Pi said. But until they do, why don't you sleep for a while?
You must be kidding.
At least stop pacing about.
I've never been locked up by anybody before. It makes me claustrophobic.
One pneuma and you could be out of here, Pi reminded him.
Maybe that's what we should be doing.
If we're pressed. But we're not yet. For Christ's sake, lie down.
Reluctantly, Gentle did so, and despite the anxieties that lay down beside him to whisper in his ear, his body was more interested in rest than their company, and he quickly fell asleep. He was woken by Pi, who murmured,
"You've got a visitor."
He sat up. The cell's light had been turned off, and had it not been for the smell of oil paint, he'd not have known the identity of the man at the door.
"Zacharias, I need your help."
"What's wrong?"
"Who's that? He's... I think she's going crazy. You've got to come."
His whispering voice trembled. So did the hand he laid on Gentle's arm.
"I think she's dying," he said.
"If I go, Pi comes too."
"No, I can't take that risk."
"And I can't take the risk of leaving my friend here," Gentle said.
"And I can't take the risk of being found out. If there isn't somebody in the cell when the guard passes..."
"He's right," said Pi.
"Go on, help the child."
"Is that wise?"
"Compassion's always wise."
"All right, but stay awake. We haven't said our prayers yet. We need both our breaths for that."
"I understand."
Gentle slipped out into the passage with Aping, who winced at every click the key made as he locked the door. So did Gentle. The thought of leaving Pi alone in the cell sickened him, but there seemed to be no other choice.
"We may need a doctor's help,"
Gentle said as they crept down the darkened corridors.
"I suggest you fetch Scopeek from his cell."
"Is he a doctor?"
"He certainly is."
"It's you she's asking for," Aping said. "I don't know why. She just woke up, sobbing and begging me to fetch you. She's so cold."
With Aping's knowledge of how regularly each floor and passageway was patrolled to aid them, they reached Hazar's cell without encountering a single guard. The girl wasn't lying on her bed, as Gentle had expected, but was crouched on the floor with her head and hands pressed against one of the walls. A single wick burned in a bowl in the middle of the cell, her face unwarmed by its light. Though she registered their appearance with a glance, she didn't move from the wall, so Gentle went to where she was crouching and did the same. Shudders passed through her body, though her bangs were plastered to her brow with sweat.
"What can you hear?"
Gentle asked her.
"She's not in my dreams any more, Mr. Zacharias," she said,
pronouncing his name with precision, as though the proper naming of the forces around her would offer her some little control over them.
"Where is she?"
Gentle inquired.
"She's outside. I can hear her. Listen."
He put his head to the wall. There was indeed a murmur in the stone, though he guessed its source was either the asylum's generator or its furnace, rather than the cradle lady.
"Do you hear?"
"Yes, I hear."
"She wants to come in," Hazar said. "She tried to come in through my dreams, but she couldn't, so now she's coming through the wall."
"Maybe we should move away then,"
Gentle said, reaching to put his hand on the girl's shoulder. She was icy.
"Come on, let me take you back to bed. You're cold."
"I was in the sea," she said,
allowing Gentle to put his arms around her and draw her to her feet. He looked towards Aping and mouthed the word Scopeek. Seeing his daughter's frailty, the sergeant went from the door as obediently as a dog, leaving his Hussar clinging to Gentle. He set her down on the bed and wrapped a blanket around her.
"The cradle lady knows you're here,"
Hussar said.
"Does she?"
"She told me she almost drowned you, but you wouldn't let her."
"Why would she want to do that?"
"I don't know. You'll have to ask her when she comes in."
"You're not afraid of her?"
"Oh, no. Are you?"
"Well, if she tried to drown me..."
"She won't do that again. If you stay with me, she likes me, and if she knows I like you, she won't hurt you."
"That's good to know,"
Gentle said.
"What would she think if we were to leave here tonight?"
"We can't do that."
"Why not?"
"I don't want to go up there," she said. "I don't like it."
"Everybody's asleep," he said. "We could just
tiptoe away, you and me and my friends.
That wouldn't be so bad, would it?
She looked unpersuaded.
I think your papa would like us to go to his Ordorex. Have you ever been there?
When I was very little.
We could go again.
Hosar shook her head.
The cradle lady won't let us,
she said.
She might, if she knew that was what you wanted. Why don't we go up and have a look?
Hosar glanced back towards the wall as if she was expecting Tishalule's tide to crack the stone there and then. When nothing happened, she said,
Isodarex is a very long way, isn't it?
It's quite a journey, yes.
I've read about it in my books.
Why don't you put on some warm clothes?
Gentle said. Her doubts banished by the tacit approval of the goddess, Hosar got up and went to select some clothes from her meagre wardrobe, which hung from hooks on the opposite wall. Gentle took the opportunity to glance through the small stack of books at the end of the bed. Several were entertainments for children, keepsakes, perhaps, of happier times. One was a hefty encyclopedia by someone called Mabelome, which might have made informative reading under other circumstances, but was too densely printed to be skimmed and too heavy to be taken along. There was a volume of poems that read like nonsense rhymes, and what appeared to be a novel, Hosar's place in it marked with a slip of paper. He pocketed it when her back was turned as much for himself as her, then went to the door in the hope that Aping and Scopique were within sighting distance. There was no sign. Hosar had meanwhile finished dressing.
I'm ready, she said. Shall we go? Papa will find us.
I hope so, Gentle replied.
Certainly remaining in the cell was a waste of valuable time. Hosar asked if she could take Gentle's hand, to which he said of course, and together they began to thread their way through the passageways, all of which looked bewilderingly alike in the semi-darkness. Their progress was halted several times when the sound of boots on stone announced the proximity of guards. But Hosar was as alive to their danger as Gentle, and twice saved them from discovery. And then, as they climbed the final flight of stairs that would bring them out into the open air, a din erupted not far from them. They both froze, drawing back into the shadows, but they weren't the cause of the commotion. It was Nashap's voice that came echoing along the corridor, accompanied by a dreadful hammering. Gentle's first thought was of Pi, and before common sense could intervene, he'd broken cover and was heading towards the source of the sound, glancing back once to signal that Hosar should stay where she was, only to find that she was already on his heels. He recognized the passageway ahead. The open door 20 yards from where he stood was the door of the cell he'd left Pi in, and it was from there that the sound of Nashap's voice emerged, a garbled stream of insults and accusations that was already bringing guards running. Gentle drew a deep breath, preparing for the violence that was surely inevitable now.
No further, he told Hosar, then raced towards the open door.
3 guards, 2 of them Ethaks, were approaching from the opposite direction, but only one of the 2 had his eyes on Gentle. The man shouted an order which Gentle didn't catch over Nashap's cacophony, but Gentle raised his arms, open-palmed, fearful that the man would be trigger-happy, and at the same time slowed his run to a walk. He was within 10 paces of the door, but the guards were there ahead of him. There was a brief exchange with Nashap, during which Gentle had time to halve the distance between himself and the door, but a second order, this time plainly a demand that he stand still, backed up by the guards training his weapon at Gentle's heart, brought him to a halt. He'd no sooner done so than Nashap emerged from the cell, with one hand in Pi's ringlets and the other holding his sword, a gleaming sweep of steel to the mistiff's belly. The scars on Nashap's swollen head were inflamed by the drink in his system. The rest of his skin was dead white, almost waxen. He reeled as he stood in the doorway, all the more dangerous for his lack of equilibrium. The mistiff had proved in New York it could survive traumas that would have laid any human dead in the gutter, but Nashap's blade was ready to gut it like a fish, and there'd be no surviving that. The commander's tiny eyes fixed as best they could on Gentle.
Your mistiff's very faithful all of a sudden, he said, panting. Why's that? First it comes looking for me, then it won't let me near it. Maybe it needs your permission, is that it? So give it!
He pushed the blade against Pi's belly.
Go on! Tell it to be friendly, or it's dead!
Gentle lowered his hands a little, very slowly, as if in an attempt to appeal to Pi.
I don't think we have much choice, he said, his eyes going between the Mistiff's impassive face and the sword poised at its belly, putting the time it would take for Enuma to blow Nashap's head off against the speed of the captain's blade. Nashap was not the only player in the scene, of course. There were three guards already here, all armed and doubtless more on their way.
You better do what he wants, Gentle said,
drawing a deep breath as he finished speaking. Nashap saw him do so, and saw, too, his hand going to his mouth. Even drunk, he sensed his danger and loosed a shout to the men in the passageway behind him, stepping out of their line of fire and Gentle's as he did so. Denied one target, Gentle unleashed his breath against the other. The pneuma flew at the guards as their trigger fingers tightened, striking the nearest with such violence his chest erupted. The force of the blow threw the body back against the other two. One went down immediately, his weapon flying from his hand. The other was momentarily blinded by blood and a shrapnel of innards, but was quick to regain his balance, and would have blown Gentle's head off had his target not been on the move, flinging himself towards the corpse. The guard fired once, wildly, but before he could fire again, Gentle had snatched up the dropped weapon and answered the fire with his own. The guard had enough Ethak blood to be indifferent to the bullets that came his way, till one found his spattered eye and blew it out. He shrieked and fell back, dropping his gun to clamp both hands to the wound. Ignoring the third man, still moaning on the floor, Gentle went to the cell door. Inside, Captain Nashap stood face to face with Pai O'Par. The Mistiff's hand was on the blade. Blood ran from the sliced palm, but the commander was making no attempt to do further damage. He was staring at Pai's face, his own expression perplexed. Gentle halted, knowing any intervention on his part would snap Nashap out of his distracted state. Whoever he was seeing in Pai's place, the whore who resembled his mother, perhaps, another echo of Tisha Lule in this place of lost mamas. It was sufficient to keep the blade from removing the Mistiff's fingers. Tears began to well in Nashap's eyes. The Mistiff didn't move, nor did its gaze flicker from the captain's face for an instant. It seemed to be winning the battle between Nashap's desire and his murderous intention. His hand unknotted from around the sword. The Mistiff opened his own fingers, and the weight of the sword carried it out of the captain's grip to the ground. The noise it made, striking the stone, was too loud to go unheard by Nashap, however entranced he was, and he shook his head violently, his gaze going instantly from Pai's face to the weapon that had fallen between them. The Mistiff was quick, at the door in two strides. Gentle drew breath, but as his hand went to his mouth, he heard a shriek from Huzar. He glanced down the corridor towards the child, who was retreating before two more guards, both Ethaks, one snatching at her as she fled, the other with his sights on Gentle. Pai seized his arm and dragged him back from the door as Nashap, still rising as he came, ran at them with his sword. The time to dispatch him with a pneuma had passed. All Gentle had space to do was seize the door handle and slam the cell closed. The key was in the lock, and he turned it as Nashap's bulk slammed against the other side. Huzar was running now, her pursuer between the second guard and his target. Tossing the gun to Pai, Gentle went to snatch Huzar up before the Ethak took her. She was in his arms with a stride to spare, and he flung them both aside to give Pai a clear line of fire. The pursuing Ethak realized his jeopardy and went for his own weapon. Gentle looked around at Pai.
"Kill the fuckers!"
he yelled, but the Mistiff was staring at the gun in its hand as though it had found shite there.
"Pai! For Christ's sake, kill them!"
Now the Mistiff raised the gun, but still it seemed incapable of pulling the trigger.
"Do it!"
Gentle yelled. The Mistiff shook its head, however, and would have lost them all their lives had two clean shots not struck the back of the guards' necks, dropping them both to the ground.
"Papa!"
Huzar said. It was indeed the sergeant, with Skopeek in tow, who emerged through the smoke. His eyes weren't on his daughter, whom he'd just saved from death. They were on the soldiers he'd dispatched to do so. He looked traumatized by the deed. Even when Huzar went to him, sobbing with relief and fear, he barely noticed her. It wasn't until Gentle shook him from his daze of guilt, saying they should get going while they had half a chance, that he spoke.
"They were my men," he said.
"And this is your daughter," Gentle replied. "You made the right choice."
Nashap was still battering at the cell door, yelling for help. It could only be moments before he got it.
"What's the quickest way out?"
Gentle asked Scopeek.
I want to let the others out first, Scopeek replied. Father Athanasius, Isaac, squalling.
There's no time, Gentle said. Tell him, Pi, we have to go now or not at all. Pi, are you with us?
Yes.
Then stop dreaming and let's get going. Still protesting that they couldn't leave the rest under lock and key, Scopeek led the quintet up by a back way into the night air. They came out not onto the parapet, but onto bare rock.
Which way now?
Gentle asked. There was already a proliferation of shouts from below. Nashab had doubtless been liberated and would be ordering a full alert.
We have to head for the nearest landfall. That's the peninsula, Scopeek said,
redirecting Gentle's gaze across the cradle towards an arm of low-lying land that was barely discernible in the murk of the night. That murk was their best ally now. If they moved fast enough, it would cloak them before their pursuers even knew which direction they'd headed in. There was a beetling pathway down the island's face to the shore, and Gentle led the way, aware that every one of the four who were following was a liability. Huzar, a child, her father still racked by guilt, Scopeek casting backwards glances, and Pi still dazed by the bloodshed. This last was odd, in a creature he'd first encountered in the guise of assassin. But then this journey had changed them both. As they reached the shore, Scopeek said,
I'm sorry, I can't go. You all head on. I'm going to try and get back in and let the others out.
Gentle didn't attempt to persuade him otherwise.
If that's what you want to do, good luck, he said. We have to go.
Of course you do. Pi, I'm sorry, my friend, but I couldn't live with myself if I turned my back on the others. We've suffered too long together.
He took the Mistiff's hand.
Before you say it, I'll stay alive. I know my duty, and I'll be ready when the time comes.
I know you will, the Mistiff replied, drawing the handshake into an embrace.
It will be soon, Scopeek said.
Sooner than I'd wish, Pi replied. Then, leaving Scopeek to head back up the cliff face, the Mistiff joined Gentle, Huzar, and Aping, who were already 10 yards from the shore. The exchange between Pi and Scopeek, with its intimation of a shared agenda hitherto kept secret, had not gone unnoted by Gentle, nor would it go unquestioned. But this was not the time. They had at least 6 miles to travel before they reached the peninsula, and there was already a swell of noise from behind them, signalling pursuit. Torch beams raked the shore as the first of Nashap's troops emerged to give chase, and from within the walls of the asylum rose the din of the prisoners, finally giving voice to their rage. That, like the murk, might confound the hounds, but not for long. The torches had found Scopeek, and the beams now scanned the shore he'd been ascending from, each sweep wider than the one that preceded it. Aping was carrying Huzar, which speeded their progress somewhat, and Gentle was just beginning to think that they might stand a chance of survival when one of the torches caught them. It was weak at such a distance, but strong enough that its light picked them out. Gunfire followed immediately. They were difficult targets, however, and the bullets went well wide.
"They'll catch us now," Aping gasped. "We should surrender."
He set his daughter down and threw his gun to the ground, turning to spit his accusations in Gentle's face.
"Why did I ever listen to you? I was crazy."
"If we stay here, they'll shoot us on the spot," Gentle replied. "Huzar as well. Do you want that?"
"They won't shoot us,"
he said, taking hold of Huzar with one hand and raising the other to catch the beams.
"Don't shoot," he yelled. "Don't shoot, Captain. Captain, sir, we surrender."
"Fuck this,"
Gentle said, and reached to haul Huzar from her father's grip. She went into Gentle's arms readily, but Aping wasn't about to relinquish her so easily. He turned to snatch her back, and as he did so, a bullet struck the ice at their feet. He let Huzar go and turned to attempt a second appeal. 2 shots cut him short, the first striking his leg, the second his chest. Huzar let out a shriek and wrenched herself from Gentle's hold, dropping to the ground at her father's head. The seconds they'd lost in Aping's surrender and death were the difference between the slimmest hope of escape and none. Any one of the 20 or so troops advancing upon them now could pick them off at this distance. Even Nashap, who was leading the group, his walk still unsteady, could scarcely have failed to bring them down.
"What now?" said Pi.
"We have to stand our ground," Gentle replied. "We've got no choice."
That very ground, however, was no steadier than Nashap's walk. Though this dominion's suns were in another hemisphere, and there was only midnight from horizon to horizon, a tremor was moving through the frozen sea that both Pi and Gentle recognized from almost fatal experience. Hussar felt it too. She raised her head, her sobs quieting.
"The lady," she murmured.
"What about her?" said Gentle.
"She's near us."
Gentle put out his hand and Hussar took it. As she got up, she scanned the ground. So did he. His heart had started to pound furiously as the memories of the cradle's liquefaction flooded back.
"Can you stop her?" he murmured to Hussar.
"She's not come for us," the girl said,
and her gaze went from the still solid ground beneath their feet to the group that Nashap was still leading in their direction.
"Oh, goddess," Gentle said.
A cry of alarm was rising from the middle of the approaching pack. One of the torch beams went wild, then another, and another, as one by one the soldiers realized their jeopardy. Nashap let out a shout himself, a demand for order among his troops that went unobeyed. It was difficult to see precisely what was going on, but Gentle could imagine it well enough. The ground was softening, and the cradle's silver waters were bubbling up around their feet. One of the men fired into the air as the sea's shell broke beneath him. Another two or three started back towards the island, only to find their panic excited a quicker dissolution. They went down as if snatched by sharks, silver spume fountaining where they'd stood. Nashap was still attempting to preserve some measure of command, but it was a lost cause. Realizing this, he began to fire towards the trio, but with the ground rocking beneath him and the beams no longer trained on his targets, he was virtually shooting blind.
"We should get out of here,"
Gentle said, but Hussar had better advice.
"She won't hurt us if we're not afraid," she said.
Gentle was half tempted to reply that he was indeed afraid, but he kept his silence and his place, despite the fact that the evidence of his eyes suggested the goddess had no patience with dividing the bad from the misguided or the unrepentant from the prayerful. All but four of their pursuers, Nashap numbered among them, had already been claimed by the sea. Some gone beneath the tide entirely, others still struggling to reach some solid place. Gentle saw one man scrambling up out of the water, only to have the ground he was crawling upon liquefy beneath him with such speed the cradle had closed over him before he had time to scream. Another went down shouting at the water that was bubbling up around him, the last sight of him his gun, held high and still firing. All the torch carriers had succumbed now, and the only illumination was from the cliff top, where soldiers who'd had the luck to be left behind were training their beams on the massacre, throwing into silhouette the figures of Nashap and the other three survivors, one of whom was making an attempt to race towards the solid ground where Gentle, Pi, and Hussar stood. His panic undid him. He'd only run five strides when silvery foam bubbled up in front of him. He turned to retrace his steps, but the route had already gone to seething silver. In desperation, he flung away his weapons and attempted to leap to safety, but fell short and went from sight in an instant. One of the remaining trio, an Ethak, had fallen to his knees to pray, which merely brought him closer to his executioner, who drew him down in the throes of his imprecation, giving him time only to snatch at his comrade's leg and pull him down at the same time. The place where they'd vanished did not cease to seethe, but redoubled its fury now. Nashap, the last alive, turned to face it, and as he did so, the sea rose up like a fountain until it was half his height again.
"Lady,"
Hussar said. It was. Carved in water, a breasted body and a face dancing with glints and glimmers. The goddess, or her image, made of her native stuff, then gone the same instant as it broke and dropped upon Nashap. He was borne down so quickly, and the cradle left rocking so placidly the instant after, it was as though his mother had never made him. Slowly, Hussar turned to Gentle. Though her father was dead at her feet, she was smiling in the gloom, the first open smile Gentle had seen on her face.
"The cradle lady came,"
she said. They waited a while, but there were no further visitations. What the goddess had done, whether it was to save the child, as Hussar would always believe, or because circumstance had put within her reach the forces that had tainted her cradle with their cruelty, She had done with an economy she wasn't about to spoil with gloating or sentiment. She closed the sea with the same efficiency she'd employed to open it, leaving the place unmarked. There was no further attempt at pursuit from the guards left on the cliff, though they kept their places, torches piercing the murk.
"We've got a lot of sea to cross before dawn," Pye said. "We don't want the sun's coming up before we reach the peninsula."
Hosar took Gentle's hand.
"Did Papa ever tell you where we're going in Isodorex?"
"No,"
he said, "but we'll find the house." She didn't look back at her father's body, but fixed her eyes on the grey bulk of the distant headland and went without complaint, sometimes smiling to herself as she remembered that the night had brought her a glimpse of a parent that would never again desert her. Chapter 29. 1. The territory that lay between the shores of the Cradle and the limits of the Third Dominion had been, until the Autarch's intervention, the site of a natural wonder universally held to mark the centre of the Imagicka, a column of perfectly hewn and polished rock to which as many names and powers had been ascribed as there were shamans, poets, and storytellers to be moved by it. There was no community within the reconciled dominions that had not enshrined it in their mythology and found an epithet to mark it as their own. But its truest name was also perhaps its plainest, the Pivot. Controversy had raged for centuries about whether the Unbeheld had set it down in the smoky wastes of the Quem to mark the midpoint between the perimeters of the Imagicka, or whether a forest of such columns had once stood in the area, and some later hand, moved perhaps by Hapexamendios's wisdom, had levelled all but this one. Whatever the arguments about its origins, however, nobody had ever contested the power that it had accrued standing at the centre of the dominions. Lines of thought had passed across the Quem for centuries, carrying a freight of force which the Pivot had drawn to itself with a magnetism that was virtually irresistible. By the time the Autarch came into the Third Dominion, having already established his particular brand of dictatorship in his Isodorex, the Pivot was the single most powerful object in the Imagicka. He laid his plans for it brilliantly, returning to the palace he was still building in his Isodorex and adding several features, though their purpose did not become apparent until almost 2 years later, when, acting with a kind of speed that usually attends a coup, he had the Pivot toppled, transported, and set in a tower in his palace before the blood of those who might have raised objections to this sacrilege was dry. Overnight, the geography of the Imagicka was transformed. Isodorex became the heart of the dominions. Thereafter, there would be no power, either secular or sacred, that did not originate in that city. There would be no crossroads sign in any of the reconciled dominions that did not carry its name, nor any highway that did not have upon it somewhere a petitioner or penitent who turned his eyes towards Isodorex in hope of salvation. Prayers were still uttered in the name of the Unbeheld, and blessings murmured in the forbidden names of the goddesses, but Isodorex was the true lord now, the Autarch its mind, and the Pivot its phallus. 179 years had passed since the day the Quem had lost its great wonder, but the Autarch still made pilgrimages into the wastes when he felt the need for solitude. Some years after the removal of the Pivot, he'd had a small palace built close to the place where it had stood, spartan by comparison with the architectural excesses of the folly that crowned Isodorex. This was his retreat in confounding times, where he could meditate upon the sorrows of absolute power, leaving his military high command, the generals who ruled the dominions on his behalf, to do so under the eye of his once-beloved queen, Quasar. Lately she had developed a taste for repression that was waning in him, and he'd several times thought of retiring to the palace in the Quem permanently, and leaving her to rule in his stead, given that she took so much more pleasure from it than he. But such dreams were an indulgence, and he knew it. Though he ruled the Imagicka invisibly, not one soul outside the circle of 20 or so who dealt with him daily would have known him from any other white man with good taste in clothes, his vision had shaped the rise of Isodorex, and no other would ever competently replace it. On days like this, however, with the cold air off, the Lenten Way whining in the spires of the Quem Palace, he wished he could send the mirror he met in the morning back to Isordrex in his place and let his reflection rule. Then he could stay here and think about the distant past. England in midsummer. The streets of London bright with rain when he woke, the fields outside the city peaceful and buzzing with bees, scenes he pictured longingly when he was in elegiac mood. Such moods seldom lasted long, however. He was too much of a realist, and he demanded truth from his memory. Yes, there had been rain, but it had come with such venom it had bruised every fruit it hadn't beaten from the bough. And the hush of those fields had been a battlefield's hush, the murmur not trees, but flies come to find laying places. His life had begun that summer, and his early days had been filled with signs not of love and fruitfulness, but of apocalypse. There wasn't a preacher in the park who didn't have revelation by heart that year, nor a whore in Drury Lane who wouldn't have told you she'd seen the devil dancing on the midnight roofs. How could those days not have influenced him, filled him with a horror of imminent destruction, given him an appetite for order, for law, for empire? He was a child of his times, and if they'd made him cruel in his pursuit of system, was that his fault, or that of the age? The tragedy lay not in the suffering that was an inevitable consequence of any social movement, but in the fact that his achievements were now in jeopardy from forces that, if they won the day, would return the Imagicka to the chaos from which he had brought it, undoing his work in a fraction of the time it had taken for it to be achieved. If he was to suppress these subversive elements, he had a limited number of options. And after the events in Padashokwa and the uncovering of plots against him, he had retreated to the quiet of the Quem Palace to decide between them. He could continue to treat the rebellions, strikes and uprisings as minor irritations, limiting his reprisals to small but eloquent acts of suppression, such as the burning of the village of Beatrix and the trials and executions at Vanayef. This route had two significant disadvantages. The most recent attempt upon his life, though still inept, was too close for comfort. And until every last radical and revolutionary had been silenced or dissuaded, he would be in danger. Furthermore, when his whole reign had been dotted with episodes that had required some measured brutalities, would this new spate of purges and suppressions make any significant mark? Perhaps it was time for a more ambitious vision. Cities put under martial law, tetrarchs imprisoned so that their corruptions could be exposed in the name of a just Isordrex, governments toppled and resistance met with the full might of the Second Dominion's armies. Maybe Padashokwa would have to burn the way Beatrix had, or Limby and its wretched temples. If such a route were followed successfully, the slate would be wiped clean. If not, if his advisers had underestimated the scale of unrest or the quality of leaders among the rabble, he might find the circle closing, and the apocalypse into which he'd been born that faraway summer coming around again, here in the heart of his promised land. What, then, if Isordrex burned instead of Padashokwa? Where would he go for comfort? Back to England, perhaps? Did the house in Clerkenwell still stand, he wondered, and if so were its rooms still sacred to the workings of desire, or had the maestro's undoing scoured them to the last board and nail? The questions tantalized him. As he sat and pondered them, he found a curiosity in his core. No, more than curiosity, an appetite to discover what the unreconciled dominion was like, almost 2 centuries after his creation. His musings were interrupted by Rosengarten, a name he'd bequeathed to the man in a spirit of irony, for a more infertile thing never walked. Piebald from a disease caught in the swamps of Lockwiot, in the throes of which he had unmanned himself, Rosengarten lived for duty. Among the generals he was the only one who didn't sin with some excess against the austerity of these rooms. He spoke and moved quietly. He didn't stink of perfumes, he never drank, he never ate crouchy. He was a perfect emptiness, and the only man the Autarch completely trusted. He had come with news and told it plainly. The asylum on the cradle of Jasemet had been the scene of a rebellion. Almost all the garrison had been killed under circumstances which were still under investigation, and the bulk of the prisoners had escaped, led by an individual called Skopik.
"How many were there?"
the autarch asked.
"I have a list, sir,"
Rosengarten replied, opening the file he'd brought with him.
"There are 51 individuals unaccounted for, most of them religious dissidents."
"Women?"
"None."
"We should have had them executed, not locked them away."
"Several of them would have welcomed martyrdom, sir. The decision to incarcerate them was taken with that in mind."
"So now they'll return to their flocks and preach revolution all over again. This we must stop. How many of them were active in his orderex?"
"9, including Father Athanasius."
"Athanasius? Who was he?"
"The duffer who claimed he was the Christos. He had a congregation near the harbour."
"Then that's where he'll return, presumably."
"It seems likely."
"All of them will go back to their flocks, sooner or later. We must be ready for them. No arrests, no trials. Just have them quietly dispatched."
"Yes, sir."
"I don't want Quaiswar informed of this."
"I think she knows already, sir."
"Then she must be prevented from anything showy."
"I understand."
"Let's do this discreetly."
"There is something else, sir."
"What's that?"
"There were 2 other individuals on the island before the rebellion."
"What about them?"
"It's difficult to know exactly what to make of the report. One of them appears to have been a mischief. The description of the other may be of interest."
He passed the report to the autarch, who scanned it quickly at first, then more intently. "How reliable is this?" he asked Rosengarten.
"At this juncture, I don't know. The descriptions were corroborated, but I haven't interrogated the men personally."
"Do so."
"Yes, sir."
He handed the report back to Rosengarten. "How many people have seen this?"
"I had all other copies destroyed as soon as I read it. I believe only the interrogating officers, their commander, and myself have been party to this information."
"I want every one of the survivors from the garrison silenced. Court-martial them all and throw away the key. The officers and the commander must be instructed that they will be held accountable for any leakage of this information from any source. Such leakage to be punishable by death."
"Yes, sir."
"As for the mischief and the stranger, we must assume them making way to the Second Dominion. First Beatrix, now the Cradle. Their destination must be Isorderex. How many days since this uprising?"
11, sir."
"Then they'll be in Isorderex in a matter of days, even if they're travelling on foot. Track them. I'd like to know as much about them as I can." He looked out the window at the wastes of the Quem. "They probably took the Lenten way, probably passed within a few miles of here." There was a subtle agitation in his voice. "That's twice now our paths have come close to crossing. And now the witnesses, describing him so well. What does it mean, Rosengarten? What does it mean?" When the commander had no answers, as now, he kept his silence. An admirable trait. "I don't know either," the autarch said. "Perhaps I should go out and take the air. I feel old today." The hole from which the pivot had been uprooted was still visible, though the driving winds of the region had almost healed the scar. Standing on the lips of the hole was a fine place to meditate on absence, the autarch had discovered. He tried to do so now, his face swathed in silk to keep the stinging gust from his mouth and nostrils, his long fur coat closely buttoned, and his gloved hands driven into his pockets. But the calm he'd always derived from such meditations escaped him now. Absence was a fine discipline for the spirit when the world's bounty was a step away, and boundless. Not so now. Now it reminded him of an emptiness that he both feared and feared to be filled, like the haunted place at the shoulder of a twin who'd lost its other in the womb. However high he built his fortress walls, however tightly he sealed his soul, there was one who would always have access. And that thought brought palpitations. This other knew him as well as he knew himself. His frailties, his desires, his highest ambition. Their business together, most of it bloody, had remained unrevealed and unrevenged for 2 centuries. But he had never persuaded himself that it would remain so forever. It would be finished at last. And soon. Though the cold could not reach his flesh through his coat, the autarch shuddered at the prospect. He had lived for so long, like a man who walks perpetually in the noonday sun, his shadow falling neither in front of him nor behind. Prophets could not predict him, nor accusers catch his crimes. He was inviolate. But that would change now. When he and his shadow met, as they inevitably would, the weight of 1,000 prophecies and accusations would fall upon them both. He pulled the silk from his face and let the eroding wind assault him. There was no purpose in staying here any longer. By the time the wind had remade his features, he would have lost his Ordrex, and even though that seemed like a small forfeit now, in the space of hours, it might be the only prize he'd be able to preserve from destruction. 2. If the divine engineers who had raised the Jokalela had one night set their most ambitious peak between a desert and an ocean, and returned the next night, and for a century of nights thereafter, to carve its steeps and sheers from foothills to clouded heights, with lowly habitations and magnificent plazas, with streets, bastions, and pavilions, and if, having carved, they had set in the core of that mountain a fire that smouldered but never burned, then their handiwork, when filled to overflowing with every manner of life, might have deserved comparison with his Ordrex. But given that no such masterwork had ever been devised, the city stood without parallel throughout the Imagica. The travellers' first sight of it came as they crossed the causeway that skipped like a well-aimed stone across the delta of the River Noy, rushing in 12 white torrents to meet the sea. It was early morning when they arrived, the fog off the river conspiring with the uneasy light of dawn to keep the city from sight until they were so close to it that when the fog was snatched, the sky was barely visible, the desert and the sea no more than marginal, and all the world was suddenly Isordrex. As they'd walked the Lenten Way, passing from the Third Dominion into the Second, Hozar had recited all she'd read about the city from her father's books. One of the writers had described Isordrex as a god, she reported, a notion Gentle had thought ludicrous until he set eyes upon it. Then he understood what the urban theologian had been about, deifying this termite hill. Isordrex was worthy of worship, and millions were daily performing the ultimate act of veneration, living on or within the body of their lord. Their dwellings clung like a million panicked climbers to the cliffs above the harbour and teetered on the plateaus that rose tier on tier towards the summit, many so crammed with houses that those closest to the edge had to be buttressed from below, the buttresses in turn encrusted with nests of life, winged perhaps, or else suicidal. Everywhere the mountain teemed, its streets of steps lethally precipitous, leading the eye from one brimming shelf to another, from leafless boulevards lined with fine mansions to gates that let onto shadowy arcades, then up to the city's 6 summits, on the highest of which stood the palace of the Autarch of the Imagica. There was an abundance of a different order here, for the palace had more domes and towers than Rome, their obsessive elaboration visible even at this distance. Rising above them all was the pivot tower, as plain as its fellows were baroque. And high above that again, hanging in the white sky above the city, the comet that brought the Dominion's long days and languid dusks, Isordrex's star, called Geis, the Witherer. They stood for only a minute or so to admire the sight. The daily traffic of workers who, having found no place of residence on the back or in the bowels of the city, commuted in and out daily, had begun. And by the time the newcomers reached the other end of the causeway, they were lost in a dusty throng of vehicles, bicycles, rickshaws and pedestrians, all making their way into Isordrex. 3, among tens of thousands. A scrawny young girl wearing a wide smile. A white man, perhaps once handsome but sickly now, his pale face half lost behind a ragged brown beard. And a Yerhatemic mistiff, its eyes, like so many of its breed, barely concealing a private grief. The crowd bore them forward, and they went unresisting where countless multitudes had gone before, into the belly of the city god Isordrex. Chapter 30.
1. When Dowd brought Judith back to Godolphin's house after the murder of Clara Leash, it was not as a free agent, but as a prisoner. She was confined to the bedroom she'd first occupied, and there she waited for Oscar's return. When he came in to see her, it was after a half-hour conversation with Dowd. She heard the murmur of their exchange, but not its substance, and he told her as soon as he appeared that he had no wish to debate what had happened. She'd acted against his best interests, which were finally, did she not realize this yet, against her own too, and he would need time to think about the consequences for them both.
"I trusted you," he said, "more than I've ever trusted any woman in my life. You betrayed me, exactly the way Dowd predicted you would. I feel foolish, and I feel hurt."
"Let me explain," she said.
He raised his hands to hush her.
"I don't want to hear," he said. "Maybe in a few days we'll talk, but not now."
Her sense of loss at his retreat was almost overwhelmed by the anger she felt at his dismissal of her. Did he believe her feelings for him were so trivial she'd not concerned herself with the consequences of her actions on them both? Or worse, had Dowd convinced him that she'd been planning to betray him from the outset, and she'd calculated everything, the seduction, the confessions of devotion, in order to weaken him? This latter scenario was the likelier of the two, but it didn't clear Oscar of guilt. He had still failed to give her a chance to justify herself. She didn't see him for 3 days. Her food was served in her room by Dowd, and there she waited, hearing Oscar come and go, and on occasion hints of conversation on the stairs, enough to gather the impression that the tabula rasa's purge was reaching a critical point. More than once, she contemplated the possibility that what she'd been up to with Clara Leash made her a potential victim, and that day by day Dowd was eroding Oscar's reluctance to dispatch her. Paranoia, perhaps. But if he had any scrap of feeling for her, why didn't he come and see her? Didn't he pine, the way she did? Didn't he want her in his bed, for the animal comfort of it, if nothing else? Several times she asked Dowd to tell Oscar she needed to speak with him, and Dowd, who affected the detachment of a jailer with 1,000 other such prisoners to deal with daily, had said he'd do his best, but he doubted that Mr. Godolphin would want to have any dealings with her. Whether the message was communicated or not, Oscar left her solitary in her confinement, and she realized that unless she took more forcible action, she might never see daylight again. Her escape plan was simple. She forced the lock on her bedroom door with a knife, unreturned after one of her meals. It wasn't the lock that kept her from straying. It was Dowd's warning that the mites which had murdered Clara were ready to claim her if she attempted to leave, and slipped out onto the landing. She'd deliberately waited until Oscar was home before she made the attempt, believing, perhaps naively, that despite his withdrawal of affection, he'd protect her from Dowd if her life was threatened. She was sorely tempted to seek him out there and then, but perhaps it would be easier to treat with him when she was away from the house and felt more like a mistress of her own destiny. If, once she was safely away from the house, he chose to have no further contact with her, then her fear that Dowd had soured his feelings towards her permanently would be confirmed, and she would have to look for another way to get to his Orderex. She made her way down the stairs with the utmost caution, and hearing voices at the front of the house, decided to make her exit through the kitchen. The lights were burning everywhere, as usual. The kitchen was deserted. She crossed quickly to the door, which was bolted top and bottom, crouching to slide the lower bolt aside. As she stood up, Dowd said,
"You won't get out that way."
She turned to see him standing at the kitchen table, bearing a tray of supper dishes. His laden condition gave her hope that she might yet outmanoeuvre him, and she made a dash for the hallway, but he was faster than she'd anticipated, setting down his burden and moving to stop her so quickly she had to retreat again, her hand catching one of the glasses on the table. It fell, smashing musically.
"Now look what you've done," he said, with what seemed to be genuine distress.
He crossed to the shards and bent down to gather them up.
"That glass had been in the family for generations. I'd have thought you'd have had some fellow feeling for it."
Though she was in no temper to talk about broken glasses, she replied nevertheless, knowing her only hope lay in alerting Godolphin to her presence.
Why should I give a damn about a glass? She said.
Dowd picked up a piece of the bowl, holding it to the light.
You've got so much in common, Lovey, he said. Both made in ignorance of yourselves. Beautiful, but fragile.
He stood up.
You've always been beautiful. Fashions come and go, but Judith is always beautiful. You don't know a damn thing about me, she said.
He put the shards on the table beside the rest of the dirty plates and cutlery.
Oh, but I do, he said. We're more alike than you realize.
He kept a glittering fragment back, and as he spoke he put it to his wrist. She only just had time to register what he was about to do before he cut into his own flesh. She looked away, but then, hearing the piece of glass dropped among the litter, glanced back. The wound gaped, but there was no blood forthcoming, just an ooze of brackish sap. Nor was the expression on Dowd's face pained. It was simply intent.
You have a piffling recall of the past, he said. I have too much. You have heat. I have none. You're in love. I've never understood the word. But Judith, we are the same. Both slaves.
She looked from his face to the cut, to his face to the cut to his face. And with every move of her pupils, her panic increased. She didn't want to hear any more from him. She despised him. She closed her eyes and conjured him at the Voider's pyre, and in the shadow of the tower, crawling with mites. But however many horrors she put between them, his words won through. She'd given up attempting to solve the puzzle of herself a long time ago, but here he was, spilling pieces she couldn't help but pick up.
Who are you? She said to him.
More to the point, who are you?
We're not the same, she said, not even a little. I bleed, you don't. I'm human, you're not.
But is it your blood you bleed? He asked. Ask yourself that.
It comes out of my veins. Of course it's mine.
Then who are you? He said.
The inquiry was made without overt malice, but she didn't doubt its subversive purpose. Somehow Dowd knew she was forgetful of her past and was pricking her to a confession.
I know what I'm not, she said,
earning herself the time to invent an answer.
I'm not a glass. I'm not fragile or ignorant, and I'm not...
What was the other quality he'd mentioned, besides beauty and fragility? He'd been stopping to pick up the pieces of broken glass, and he described her some way or other.
You're not what?
He said, watching her wrestle with her own reluctance to seize the memory. She pictured him crossing the kitchen. Now look what you've done, he'd said. Then he'd stooped. She saw him do so in her mind's eye. And as he'd begun to pick up the pieces, the words had come to his lips, and now to her memory too.
That glass has been in the family for generations, he'd said. I'd have thought you'd have had some fellow feeling for it.
No,
she said aloud, shaking her head to keep the sense of this from congealing there. But the motion only shook up other memories, of her trip to the estate with Charlie, when that pleasurable sense of belonging had suffused her and voices had called her sweet names from the past, of meeting Oscar on the threshold of the retreat and knowing instantly she belonged at his side, without question or care to question, of the portrait above Oscar's bed, gazing down on the bed with such a possessive stare he had turned off the light before they made love. As these thoughts came, the shaking of her head grew wilder, the motion possessing her like a fit. Tears spat from her eyes. Her hands went out for help even as the power to request it went from her throat. Through a blur of motion she was just able to see Dowd standing beside the table, his hand covering his wounded wrist, watching her impassively. She turned from him, terrified that she'd choke on her tongue or break her head open if she fell, and knowing he'd do nothing to help her. She wanted to cry out for Oscar, but all that came was a wretched, gargling sound. She stumbled forward, her head still thrashing, and as she did so, saw Oscar in the hallway, coming towards her. She pitched her arms in his direction and felt his hands upon her to pull her up out of her collapse. He failed. too. He was beside her when she woke. She wasn't lying in the narrow bed she'd been consigned to for the last few nights, but in the wide four-poster in Oscar's room, the bed she'd come to think of as theirs. It wasn't, of course. Its true owner was the man whose image in oils had come back to her in the throes of her fit, the mad Lord Godolphin, hanging above the pillows on which she lay and sitting beside her in a later variation, caressing her hand and telling her how much he loved her. As soon as she came to consciousness and felt his touch, she withdrew from it.
"I'm not a pet," she struggled to say. "You can't just stroke me when it suits you."
He looked appalled.
"I apologize unconditionally," he said in his gravest manner. "I have no excuse. I let the society's business take precedence over understanding you and caring for you. That was unforgivable. Then Dowd, of course, whispering in my ear. Was he very cruel?"
"You're the one who's been cruel."
"I've done nothing intentionally. Please believe that, at least."
"You've lied to me over and over again," she said,
struggling to sit up in bed.
"You know things about me that I don't. Why didn't you share them with me? I'm not a child."
"You've just had a fit," Oscar said. "Have you ever had a fit before?"
"No."
"Some things are better left alone, you see."
"Too late," she said. "I've had my fit, and I survived it. I'm ready to hear the secret, whatever it is."
She glanced up at Joshua.
"It's something to do with him, isn't it? He's got a hold on you."
"Not on me."
"You liar! You liar!"
she said, throwing the sheets aside and getting onto her knees so that she was face to face with the deceiver.
"Why do you tell me you love me one moment and lie to me the next? Why don't you trust me?"
"I've told you more than I've ever told anybody. But then I find you've plotted against the society."
"I've done more than plot," she said,
thinking of her journey into the cellars of the tower. Once again she teetered on the edge of telling him what she'd seen, but Clara's advice was there to keep her from falling. "You can't save Celestine and keep his affections," she'd said. "You're digging at the foundations of his family and his faith." It was true. She understood that more clearly than ever. And if she told him all she knew, pleasurable as that unburdening would be, could she be absolutely certain he wouldn't cleave to his history at the last and use what he knew against her? What would Clara's death and Celestine's suffering have been worth then? She was now their only agent in the living world, and she had no right to gamble with their sacrifices.
"What have you done?" Oscar said. "Besides plot. What have you done?"
"You haven't been honest with me," she replied. "Why should I tell you anything?"
"Because I can still take you to his Orderex," he said.
"Bribes now?
Don't you want to go any longer?"
"I want to know the truth about myself more."
He looked faintly saddened by this.
"Ah," he sighed. "I've been lying for so long. I'm not sure I'd know the truth if I tripped over it. Except..."
"Yes?"
"What we felt for each other," he murmured. "At least, what I feel for you. That was true, wasn't it?"
"It can't be much," Jude said. "You locked me away. You left me to Dowd."
"I've already explained."
"Yes, you were distracted. You had other business. So you forgot me."
"No," he protested. "I never forgot. Never, I..."